So for those of you that are new, every year, Tim and I and Carrie, we usually pick a theme to practice with, some Dhamma theme, and this year it happens to be the Four Noble Truths. So we spent the year going through it. And this month we do a different, I think a principle each month, and this month happens to be right speech. So that's what we're going to talk about. But I, you know, mostly when we think about right speech, we think about it in terms of how we talk to each other. So can we just talk to each other in a more dharmic or respectable way? But that was not my doorway into right speech. And, you know, I did a lot of nonviolent communication type things and all kinds of little learning how to speak right. And the language just seemed all very archaic. It just never seemed like the kind of language I would use. And so I did all these speech things, but none of it really worked with helping me to stop yelling and cussing people out. It just didn't work. It didn't work. I'm telling you, I still did a lot of cussing, a lot of yelling at people, if necessary, to get what I wanted. So I thought I would start with the Sutta Kosambi. Gil Fronsdale and I and Dora Williams, we did a retreat, Noliway Alexander, we did a retreat in April. And Gil wanted to do it on this sutta, but he wanted to do it as if we shrouded everything in metta. And what would that look like? So I want to tell you about this sutta because it'll put what I'm going to talk about in perspective, at least as it relates to me. And then we'll talk about it at the end and see what it feels like for you. But so Kosambi is, there was a group, I think Kosambi must be a town or some village, but there was a group of monks that the way it was described was, they were given to arguing and quarreling and disputing, stabbing one another with weapons of the mouth. They did not persuade one another and did not agree to be persuaded by one another. They did not convince one another and did not agree to be convinced by one another. So, yeah, that sounds a lot like my mind. For years, this is the mind I have. I wouldn't think of it that way, but this is the truth. I was forever given to quarreling, arguing in my mind, disputing everything. I didn't agree with nothing nobody said. And, you know, I probably did it more verbally, but did a lot of stabbing of other people with my mouth and things I'd say if it meant that I was going to get my way. And I didn't, you know, nobody could persuade me. Nobody could convince me that my opinion and thoughts were not right. No one. Because I was smart. I mean, I was smart. I was quick. So why would I listen to someone else? I just never could understand that. And so in my mind, I would say I was given to quarreling, arguing, disputing everything. But there's something to be noted here before we go any further. These monks didn't necessarily think they're doing something wrong. This is very important to grasp this because we all argue and we all quarrel and dispute and we are not persuaded by what other people say. We are not convinced that they know what they're talking about. We believe whatever it is that we have a belief in, we believe that that is right and that is true. And so we may not say it out loud, but we're given to this constant quarreling, disputing. It's part of why it's so difficult right now in the world, because there's so much happening in the world that goes against what we believe. And we are not convinced, nor will we be persuaded to believe otherwise, that this somehow is happening in keeping with lawful order. Doesn't make any sense. Shouldn't be like this. And so we are forever quarreling with ourselves. You know that negativity you feel about the world? That disagreement you have with the world and the way it is? That's arguing and quarreling with the way things are. And that's what he's pointing to. He's not pointing to just, me, just arguing generally with everything. But it's this way that we believe that whatever we think is right is right. And whatever we think is wrong is wrong. And we quarrel with the fact that it's in front of us all the time. So these guys were given to this. And one of the monks goes to the Buddha and says, you know, we're just quarreling all the time. We're arguing and disputing each other. And so the Buddha called all of them together and kind of talked to them a little bit and said that he was going to give them six conditions that are conducive to amiability, that engenders feelings of endearment, engenders feelings of respect, and leads to a sense of fellowship, lack of dispute, harmony, and a state of unity. So these six qualities, the way he talked about them, this is what endears us to kindness with each other, even if we don't agree. So this endears that energy. And I'm going to go through one of them, but he actually, I'm going to tell you what the six are, is that when you are involved in, and the reason why I'm telling you all six of them is because over the next 3 months, we're basically going to talk about the three of them. And the last two months ago, that's what we talked about already, the other three. So the first one is that if you're doing any kind of bodily act, you do it with kindness. That's what we're going to talk about next month. It's these bodily acts are actions. We do it with kindness to your friends. If you say anything, which is what I'm going to talk about, you do it with kindness. And if you think anything, you think it with kindness. Then he said that if you consume anything, you consume it with generosity, meaning that you don't consume anything without the thought of sharing with someone, anyone, however you share it. Just this idea of sharing brings about a degree of enduring kindness. And then you dwell in sila. So your actions, your thoughts, everything is attuned to sila, which is what we're going to talk about next month. And that your mind is attuned, your view is attuned towards right view. So all of this, the Buddha said, if it's attuned in kindness, then that kindness has an effect on you. So this is what I want to point to, because for me, right speech started in my thinking mind. So even though speech is usually out there, the difficulty I was having was inside my mind. The negativity, my quarreling, my arguing, my disputing was in my thinking mind. And so I begin to work on my thoughts and thinking mind. And that's what I want to talk about as speech. I want to talk about how we talk to ourselves. Because the way we talk to ourselves has a lot to do with how we talk to everybody else. It has a lot to do with our energies. And when I started softening and bringing kindness to the way I spoke on the inside that nobody else heard, the softer my voice got outside. But this inside quarreling and arguing and disputing, and we figure since nobody hears us, you know, it's good. We're right to be quarreling and arguing because they're wrong. And that understanding, this is what I think as practitioners, we have to learn to kind of walk aligned with. So the way I want to kind of talk to this, even though we're talking about speech, I want to talk about what the Buddha did with his mind. Because there's a sutta where he divided his thoughts up. He noticed that his thoughts were consumed with ill will. Get that. The Buddha, thoughts were consumed with ill will. He was bitching at somebody in there. Something up in there was all, probably his friends who left him, the practices and working, his back is hurting, knees are hurting. He was full of all the same aversion we have. It's not whether or not we're good practitioner, bad practitioner. Aversion and that ill will is the nature of the mind. When it doesn't like something, it begins to spin in aversion, complaining. It begins to get, what is it? It's, where's my sutra? I love the way they say it, so that's why I want to say it. We begin arguing with the knee pain, arguing, quarreling, disputing, stabbing ourselves with our mouths or our thoughts. And we are not going to be persuaded to let that arguing go. We are not even persuading ourselves in all that arguing, and we will not be convinced. So there's this arguing with our knee, when in truth, the knee is unpleasant. No amount of arguing will change that at all. One iota. And yet, that's what we spin in. That's what I spun in, is just a lot of arguing with it. So he noticed he had all this ill will in the mind. He noticed that he had all this wanting, lusting after in the mind. He had given to indulgence, he said. I mean, sometimes I crack myself up. He probably started thinking about pancakes and syrup because he's eating a grain of rice a day. That's pretty pitiful. So he would get hungry. I'm sure he got hungry. I'm sure he thought about sex. He was young. I'm sure he thought about wanting to go back to the palace and be back there. I mean, no one says that. That's what he was thinking on. But we know what it's like to get caught up in sensual thoughts and wanting something pleasant other than this. He could have just gotten caught up in wanting some blissful state, but he has all this aversion with his knee hurting or his belly being hungry or whatever. So he is also given to arguing and quarreling with himself, disputing what's happening, the truth of it getting lost in this way that we talk to ourselves when we're not saying it out loud. We're lost in it. And that process that the mind goes through, it's just a speech. And then he just talked about times when he was just careless, not paying attention to his practice, not paying attention, daydreaming, things like that. So he noticed he was doing this. And he noticed that there were other times when he didn't do that. When he had like a fire in him to stay present, to renounce all that other stuff, when he was softer, kinder, full of goodwill, good energy, and he was attentive, mindful of what's happening, steady, just a practitioner like us. What he didn't do, I mean, he may have done it before and then realized that that isn't working, but what he didn't do was shame and complain and blame himself because he had the mind that was lost in the aversion and the, you know, indulgence and just lost in fantasy. He just noticed this mind does this, this mind does this. So then he would watch the mind that was caught up in all the quarreling and begin to watch what happened to it. It got more and more and more quarreling. Didn't do anything for the knee pain, but just got more and more and more caught up in it. Just spinning. He could do a whole sit and nothing would change except for his grumbling. And then he noticed that when he was in this kinder place, softer, caring place, attentive, mindful, it feels great. It feels free. It feels easy, soft. I could sit here all day. And he saw the difference between when the mind is caught up in this quarreling, anger, and disputing, and when it's not. And when it's not caught in that quarreling energy, possibility exists for us to see something. He also noticed one more thing. He noticed, I guess I should say what he said, that he noticed that when he was caught up in that negativity, or what I would consider unskillful thoughts, you know, thoughts about not liking or wanting or whatever, the unskillfulness of it. He said he noticed that that leads to my own affliction. It leads to my own affliction and to the affliction of others and to the affliction of both of us. And it obstructs his discernment, promotes vexation, and does not lead to unbinding. This is what I think is important about what we are practicing and making this distinction. It's not his negative mind. It's not his unskillfulness. It's the recognition of what that unskillfulness is doing to him. Can you see that? Can you see the difference between just saying, oh, that is anger. That's not good. I shouldn't be angry. That's what I thought. I shouldn't be angry. I need to stop being so angry all the time. That's what I would say to myself all the time because I was so angry. I should stop that. I shouldn't be so angry. It's not good. I could never stop being angry. My mind is not going to stop being angry. Because my mind believes anger is what's going to get my way. And mostly it did. So why would it stop? It's not going to. But I thought it was bad. I should get rid of it. I should stop that. I would tell myself over and over and over, stop that. Stop that. It's not going to stop. It's a habit. It feels right to be angry when I don't agree with something. Why wouldn't I be angry? What the Buddha realized, and what I think he's pointing to us as practitioners, is don't get caught up in the anger itself, but begin to look at what that anger is doing to you. And it's doing something. It's painful. It's very painful, anger is. No matter how right we think we are, it's painful. We cannot make things change. We just push and push and push, but we can't make it change. And if we are fortunate enough to make it change, oh, that is not okay. I used to get to a place where I'd say, if anybody gave me what I wanted, I'm not taking it. If I push and you give me what I want, I'm not taking it. I'm not taking the bait. Because once you push and get your way, you will have to push again, get your way. And you will have to push again, and you will have to keep pushing and get your way. So if somebody, I remember, I don't know if you guys have ever heard the story from a colleague that went through teacher training with me. Vance Pryor said that he was in, I think he was in Burma. It was one of the first times he was in Burma. It was so hot. And he realized that the clothes he brought, like, you know, jeans, is not good walking around clothes in Burma. So they have these like cloth-like things that wrap around, you know, like a skirt, right? And he realized, oh my God, that's what I need. And his friend, I think this is it. He was doing a long practice there, and his friend had an extra one and didn't want it. And so when his friend offered it to him, he goes, no, 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 I can't take that. You keep it. I'm okay with what I have. But then he started thinking about those jeans and how hot it was, and he didn't want it. So he wanted that thing, and he wanted it in a bad way. So he went to see his friend to get it. And about the time he gets to his friend, another friend comes up. And that friend says, hey, I heard you got this, whatever that thing is called, that skirt. I heard you got that skirt thing. Can I have it? And so Ben says that he had this rage come up out of nowhere. Like, no, that is mine. And he was just overwhelmed with rage at the idea that his friend A could give it to someone else. But he wouldn't take it now. Now he can't take it. He can't take that, because if he took it, he would create a justification of that mind. So this is one of the things I begin to do with right speech. I begin to learn that if I get anything out of aversion, I don't want it. I'm not taking it, because it's not going to work. It's not going to be what I think it was. This is what I believe the Buddha began to see, that this aversive thinking, this aversive kind of wanting, lusting, grasping after, not really paying attention, just kind of going along with the habit mind, that thinking mind, that talking to ourselves actually leads to more affliction of ourselves, affliction to others, affliction of both. And it obstructs our ability to see what's happening. It obstructs our ability to discern, it promotes vexation, meaning that the mind will continue to do that, and it doesn't lead to unbinding. But when he was in this softer mind, kinder mind, this mind that had a degree of renunciation, that had a degree of care about what he was doing, the non-harming and whatnot, when he was in that mind, he noticed that all of that affliction would subside. All of that negativity or the energy that surrounds ill will would subside. He did not promote any kind of vexation, and it did lead to this sense of unbinding. He would be less and less and less caught up in it. So he would begin to practice this understanding. Oftentimes, you will be in practice in your meditation, and you will hear yourself talking in this arguing, grumbling, you know, disputing way, just arguing over whatever in your mind. Do not just stop that. Don't cut it off. Stop that. Oh, don't do that. That's not me. I want to be nicer, kinder, gentler. Don't just cut that off. See if you can notice what does it feel like in that mind. You're quiet. It's just you. What does it feel like to be in that mind? Partly I noticed how much joy I got out of it because I felt so right. It feels right to me to think this way. Part of it was the sense of being needing to win. So I think what the Buddha began to see, and I think this is what happened to me, is I began to watch my thinking as speech and begin to think of right. So right in the word, I know I say it every time, but I gotta say it every time so we can remember. Because we use the word right, we think right and wrong. But that's not what right is. Right is harmonious with the Dhamma. You are in tune with the understanding of this wisdom that you're cultivating. So you can be sitting in rage and you could start attuning to the felt sense of that rage, and you are actually in right view. You are actually right there in that moment. As rageful as you are in tune with this intention to begin to understand what's happening. And in that understanding, you are going to lead more to the unbinding and freedom than it will if you were to cut that anger off right then. Stop it. Don't have it anymore. You'll feel okay, like, okay, whew, just getting a little bit too mad here. I'm just sitting here peacefully, calmly with my breath. And you will forget that that rage will be back shortly. It will be shut back shortly because you don't know why it's showing up. You don't know where it's coming from. You don't know why it's here. So some of you know I used ants as my my neutral beings. And so whenever I would be sitting in meditation and I'd have this rage come up. You know, I came from a lot of trauma, so all this rage would come up and I'm thinking, oh, that's trauma. That's what it is. It would be just overwhelming. I'm quarreling, arguing, disputing something somebody said and how wrong that is, and I don't like this, and this is what makes me upset. I don't want to be in them. Just talking to all this. And I could feel that rage. So I started sending metta to lines of ants because, you know, one, they're cute. Two, they go up to each other and they talk to each other. I think they're going up to each other saying, maybe happy, maybe well, maybe peaceful. But alas, they are not doing that. They don't have that metta. They're just saying, what people are you from? What people are you from? What people are you from? They're just checking their peoples. But I always like to think they're just giving each other metta. But because they keep coming up to each other, I could just have a row of ants and just sit there giving metta to ants. And in the course of this giving metta to ants, I didn't give metta to ants after I was not mad anymore. I sent metta to ants while I was really, really mad, enraged, and upset. That's my go-to energy. Some people, the go-to energy, I'm talking about this from an angry place, but some of you, your go-to energy is self-hatred, self-demeaning, just this kind of diminishment, and it's more negative harm. Still ill will, but it's not this outward anger as much as it is an inward hatred. And so, same thing. I would send this metta, and gradually I begin to notice this anger shows up at a particular time in my practice. Like as soon as I start getting really, really calm, as soon as my mindfulness would get steady, really on my anchor, I feel like I'm in retreat, I'm really in there, steady. Feel like I'm doing something, accomplishing something. This anger would surge up and throw me off completely. And I'd spend the next 2 days yelling at somebody in my mind, every sit. And then I begin to notice, what's up with that anger here? I'm not mad. Why am I so mad? I mean, I sound mad, but I'm not mad. Nothing's happening. What is this? And then I begin to realize that this is the energy of practice, right? It is anybody that meditates at retreats, and you meditate for an extended period of time, you're going to start feeling this surge of energy. It just comes with the practice to help you stay mindful. In order for us to stay steady on anything, we need enough energy to keep our attention there. But because I was so prone to anger, my mind would feel that energy, hijack it, and pull up some story where I am so justified and they are so wrong. And all that energy would go into that story. And I would sit there reliving some moment, some angry moment I had in my life, some angry argument I'm going to have coming down the way. Just that's what I'm doing. Didn't have anything to do with me doing something wrong. It had to do with not realizing that the mind will hijack your practice energy. It will use that practice energy you're cultivating to do some habit mind that it has. And when I begin to realize this, I begin to just tell myself, you're not angry, Tori. That's not anger. This is not anger. And I had to convince and persuade myself, this is not anger. No matter how much it looks like anger, no matter how much I'm talking like anger, it's not anger. This is practice energy to be put into the practice. That's why I began to stay with those ants. And I started giving metta to the leaves on bushes. I would send metta to anybody and everybody. I'd take a whole patch of grass and I'd be like, each little blade, get yours, get yours, get yours. You may you be full of water, may you get plenty sun. I would just sit there because I knew, I began to understand that if I let the mind take this energy I had and turn it into some habit flow, I would not be able to steady myself. And I would just keep fighting to get still rather than getting still because I have the energy to do it. Now, the reason why I'm pointing to this on a talk about right speech is because this is really what a lot of us have to do. A lot of us are thinking constantly when we're sitting. I mean, we all think when we're sitting, just like we all hear when we're sitting. We all sense the body sitting. See, these sense doors, mind is just a sense door like everything else. But oftentimes, the mind will take us out of our practice and we will get lost in the mind's world, that whole world of talking and, you know, arguing world. That, if you see that as speech, you can begin to unhook yourself from that speech that's happening inside your mind. So there's some ways that he pointed to that could help us with this internal speech. So it's the same guidelines he gave for how to work with external speech, but I applied it to internal speech. He asked, is this being spoken at the right time? So I would ask myself, really? This is what we're going to think about here? We're going to sit here? Because, I mean, you can sit and think the whole time through, but we don't even have that much time that we could actually sit. So I would say, this is not the time for me to think about that. It's not the time. You want to know, is it true? When I say true, I mean, is it happening? Whatever I'm thinking about, is it happening in the here and now? Or is it in the past or in the future that it's making something up? So if the mind is going back in the past about something or making something up or doing some kind of evaluation, I consider that that is not true. So it's not the right time to be sitting here just thinking. It's not true. The next one is it spoken affectionately? I never spoke to myself affectionately. I barely spoke to the ants affectionately. All of them was like, no, you go. No, you go. I want to wait till I calm down. And then we could get their metta. But in the beginning, I was pretty rough on the metta. So it wasn't in this affectionate way. And I would notice oftentimes, that would be the first thing I would notice, is the harshness in which I was thinking. The level of violence that would be in my mind. And I begin to notice that violence. Is it spoken beneficially? You know, am I really trying to help myself? And mostly it was not. It was the mind taking my energy. And then lastly, is it spoken with a mind that's full of kindness, goodwill? So, if you begin to take these five qualities or these five guidelines, you could think, and hold it up to how you're talking to yourself, you can begin to see that a lot of the way we talk to ourselves is not in keeping with the Dhamma. No matter how you adjust your language on the outside, if you are not keeping with the Dhamma in the way that you talk to yourself on the inside, then that language that you're using is not truthful. It cannot, it's not in keeping with the Dhamma. It's not it's not affectionate in its way. It's not attuned to this right speech. Because it can't be. It is coming from our internal speech, just coming outward. Let me see if there's anything else I want to bring out here. In the long run, I didn't know that what I was doing when I started focusing on my inner speech more than my outer speech, I didn't know that I was actually going to create a level of kindness for myself. I didn't know that. I didn't know that kindness was going to arise out of a lot of my behavior shifted because I changed my internal speech. So what I think you could begin to sense into is just whether or not, just begin to notice how you are speaking to yourself. How you, it's not even you speaking to you oftentimes. You're speaking to someone else. But you just don't say it out loud. But it's in our minds. And we're having these conversations with other people just from our own minds inside. And you want to see, is this conversation I'm having, is it divisive? Is it harsh? Is it affectionate? So is it true? Is it timely? You know, the timely, I think, is mostly, are you even talking to the person? No, you're in your mind. You're talking in your mind. So is there this, it's not timely. You're not talking to them. You're rehearsing or you're planning a conversation. But is it harsh? Is it affectionate? No, it's harsh. It's divisive. It's harmful. And we should see that and begin to recognize it not as something's wrong with me. Because I assure you, when I first started hearing myself talk, yeah, it's a little breathtaking. I could not believe I talked to myself like that. I just couldn't believe. I thought somebody else was talking. But it was me. It's not me, it's habit. It is somebody else talking. It's all the language I heard growing up and things like that. It's just showing up again in my mind. But when we go through the trouble to listen to ourselves speaking, like speech, listen to what that thinking mind is saying, like speech, we can begin to actually see what the affliction this speaking to myself is actually having on us. And I invite you to pay more attention to your inner speech than you do on your outer. And the more you pay attention to that inner speech, the freer you're going to get. Softer you're going to get in the outer. Softer, kinder, more gracious you'll be in the outer. Thank you so much for your kind attention. I want to make sure we have some time to see if anybody has any comments or want to have any questions. We'll talk a little bit about this speech. Oh, over here.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So I had a pretty profound experience with metta at a retreat a couple of years ago. I was down in Mount Adams, and if anybody knows Tycho's in there, he's very big on meta, mm-hmm. a lot of meta. And we were having this, we went and did as part of the, during, while I was there for the retreat, they did this forest bathing, like, workshop.
Yeah.
Which is cool. I thought, oh, that's going to be great, forest bathing. And we go down there, and it's just meta. It's just meta. Meta of trees, meta with each other, meta, 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 meta. We're in circles. We're doing meta with each other over and over and over again. And, you know, all these years with meta, I've always thought of meta as like this really nice idea. Like, oh, this is great. Like, to put it out there into the universe. But it was doing this meta over and over and over and over again that all of a sudden I had like this moment, this just breakthrough, just like looking into another person's eyes and just saying, may you be well, and receiving that and saying it and receiving it. All of a sudden I had that moment of like, oh my God, this is not about putting it into the universe. This is about reconditioning my heart. Right.
Yeah.
This is about my heart.
That's right.
And it was this very profound breakthrough of compassion and not being as compassionate as I wanted to be and realizing the role that meta plays in that.
Yep.
So I've in, you know, since then, I've really thought about meta and meta practice as about compassion.
Yeah.
It's very interesting to hear you talk about meta as a way of sort of engaging with like this struggle, this klesha or whatever that you have with anger as a practice.
Yeah.
And that's not something I've ever thought about before, is how to use metta as a tool to engage with that.
It's the same compassion. It's the same thing. But the thing that's interrupting my connection is anger.
Yeah.
I couldn't connect with people or connect with life in general because I was so angry that I'm just stuck in the aversion itself.
Yeah.
So this metta that you're talking about is extremely powerful. We don't really think about it this way, but it's extremely powerful. So the same way you were forest bathing and sending metta out, I would do it with these ants,
yeah.
and these blades of grass and leaves, and have this kind of metta, and I'd have that similar kind of breakthrough where it's almost like we have to break through this thick wall of delusion that's very hard to get through because we're so afraid. If we see the truth of who we are, we get these little glimpses and we're like, oh my goodness, I can't look at that because that's terrible. But it's not you. So if you just keep looking, you will then get this realization, it's not you. It is the nature of human conditioning. And we are like Pablo's dog, you know, we just keep doing the same things over and over and over.
So like the klesha that I kind of struggle with, it's not so much anger, I mean, angry, but
right.
it's craving.
Yes.
More, right? More food, more sleep, more Netflix, whatever, like just
yeah.
more. So how might I think about like engaging metta or to deal with, to process that?
I think challenge? I would probably, so more is not liking what's here, and so you can think of it as, you want something other than what's here. And so the metta would be the softening into this is enough. This is good, just as it is. Let's just see if we could be with this as it is. And that metta is the constant softening, reminding yourself, this is enough, this is enough, this is enough. And our thoughts would be, you know, well, this is unpleasant. So how can this be enough? But clearly we should find some pleasant, right? What are we seeing here? You get to do metta to get out of your unpleasant, and I got to do metta to stay in mine. And it's not actually happening like that. If you let the moment be enough, as it is, you accept the moment as it is, you're going to see the appropriate response, which is that compassion. You'll see what is the most compassionate thing you could do in any given moment, especially when it's uncomfortable or painful. But we usually don't see the appropriate response, the compassionate response, because we're too busy in our grasping mind. And I couldn't see the hijacking of my wise energy for the anger. So that's what you're trying to see. You're trying to see that actually you can see what the most compassionate thing is to do in this moment, if you're willing to stay in the moment and be there. So softening into it.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
See down here in front.
Hey, I have yet another favorite flavor of mine, which is more the self-hateful and the critical and the plant, like some fear as well around like, gotta fix this.
Yes.
And I've been in a really challenging professional and personal spot lately, like the everyday life practice more. One of my friends, I sat the Spring Insight Retreat with you this year.
Oh.
And one of the people I met there, and I have come back to the idea of renouncing, judging, comparing and fixing. Yeah,
That's right.
Challenged me a couple times. Like, what if we just do it for 2 hours?
Maybe, that's right.
Maybe just till the end of the day. I wanted to talk about how that aligns to working with compassion in those moments, because a lot of the time when I'm really deep in the like, you screwed everything up, you need to fix it right now, you need to do everything different, your life's on the wrong track, like, and it's going really fast, I want to just stop it, because I do, like what you said about the anger really resonates with me. Like, I know that this is not a wholesome quality of mind. I see it and I'm like, you shouldn't be doing that.
That's right.
But how do I work with it in the moment? Like, I've noticed I've been using the renunciation as a challenge to just drop it, but it's not always effective or authentic to drop it when it's like, so, or I don't know if it's effective. I've been trying and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
I think part of the reason why it works or doesn't work has to do with how much you think this anxiety should go away. If you're trying to make it go away, then you're not understanding what the anxiety is actually talking about. That's what I think the Buddha's saying. You feel the affliction, but you can't see the wisdom in what's actually happening when this anxiety shows up. So you can't reassure the inner you that you're okay and steady. You know, gotta have a Dhamma talk watching Inside Out 2. That's your Dhamma talk. That's your Dhamma talk.
I've seen it. I watched it a couple weeks ago.
Oh my God. That, if you gotta see that if you let that anxiety spin, it doesn't know how to stop, because it is of the nature of anxiety to keep spinning and keep problem solving and keep fixing and keep, you know, readjusting and all of that. It will never stop itself. So there's something else that's happening when that anxiety gets triggered that you have to learn to see. And the only way we will ever see these things is we have to soften in the midst of that habit energy. So you almost have to soften into that anxiety as if you are listening to that part of you. That's where your metta is. It's sort of this kind of, let me listen, not to the frantic words underneath, but what is the underlying thing that's trying to be said? And that's the judging, comparing, fixing. That's what it's getting to. Is this Phillips pointing to the judging mind, the comparing mind, and that fixing mind are so habitual that we have some difficulty and we start judging what to do, figuring it out, comparing it with some other situation, or we're trying to fix it. And underneath that is discernment as to what is actually going on here and what can I do or not do. And so that's what you're looking for. So the metta would be softening into this mind, recognizing you almost got to get a picture of the little anxiety person so that when you feel that, you see her. She's cute. She was so helpful in the beginning. And so it's almost like you got to take the part of you that doesn't like that part and soften up around it so that it's very okay. It's just an energetic habit that when it takes over, it won't stop. And so seeing her as her, even in the end, you know, I can't remember now, it's been so long, but they just had a cute way of just helping her settle down. Just this kind of soft, kind way. And not mean. You don't have to be mean to that part of you because it's not you doing it. It's just the nature of, you know, you got to look at yourself when you were like six and they've been running around doing things. And so you're sitting there running around doing things, worrying about your parents, worrying about everybody. I mean, it's just a habit mind that the mind gets started in. And once it gets started in that mind, it just keeps going and 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 going. And then we hate that mind and we want that mind to go away. But there is something softer underneath that mind that you want to know. You want to understand so that you can reassure yourself that, you know, coming into the present moment, not extrapolating out into the past, future, but coming into the present moment. And so you won't come in the present moment as long as that anxious mind is there. And so this kind of anxious mind is trying to help you keep from having to deal with all that. But you don't have to actually get rid of the anxious mind. You just have to be willing to soften around her so she can be, you know, seen for what she's really trying to say. And not just dismissed. And certainly we don't give her the reins because she is going to make a mess of things. It will never settle down. So it's sort of that's what I like about that movie. That it's such a cartoonish movie, but you can see how all of these different aspects of ourselves interplay with each other. And that's what's happening. And so it's not a bad thing. It's just an uncomfortable thing, unpleasant thing. And until you understand what is happening and how it's triggered, then you'll always just try to get rid of it. So it's really softening more towards this anxiety energy doesn't have to go away. It's tied to your job. It's part of it. I mean, part of your job is probably I was a trial lawyer. So, you know, it's the nature of trials to be anxious. And so there's no way you're going to get rid of that panic attack before you get ready to go into a trial. It's just always going to happen. That's why I really show up late all the time. Because I'm always so scared to give a Dhamma talk that I want to make sure I go at the right last minute. Even when I'm on retreat, people will go into the hall, sit for that whole 45, 30 minute sit before the Dhamma talk. And there is no way. I go into the hall with 2 minutes to spare. So when I sit down, we're just going to start talking and I can do it. But if I have to sit there, I just will get very, very anxious, very, very anxious. So that has been with me since trials. It's just part and parcel of it. But I don't have the same panic as I used to have. So even though that panic can be there, I can still speak. I used to get very panicky. And so what I'm saying is some of that anxiety around work is because work produces that anxiety. And so this is more about allowing it to be part and parcel of what you're connected to. And then try to just see if you can soften and allow yourself to be in the present moment. And I do think the vows, as long as you make sure you keep that as best as I'm able, soften around it. That fixing mind is probably the best one. It's like, I'm just going to renounce that fixing mind. I don't have to fix anything. I have to learn to just be with it. And that will be much more supportive. Good.
Thanks.
All right. Right behind you. Nobody online has a question? It's okay. You don't have to. Just want to make sure that I don't see any hands. Go ahead.
Mine is a bit similar to hers, but a little different as well. So just thought I'd bring it up. I'll go into like guilt thought patterns really, really often. And when you were mentioning like not wanting to look at our thoughts because that's scary to see, that's something over the past few years I've actually become very, very aware of my thoughts. And because I've had this guilt pattern, I'll go into a story of guilt for, let's say I like judge a friend or something. As soon as I've judged them, I've noticed, oh, I've judged them. And after I was on a retreat, I was able to see like a judgment without this guilt story behind it. I was just able to notice, oh, that's come up. But since being like out of the retreat for a while, this story has come back. And you're saying like soften around the anxiety, yep. Soften around that. But I think for guilt, I'm just wondering what you think about that, because it can be very hard to not get wrapped up in the story of I'm doing something wrong and soften around it.
Yeah. So it's guilt to me, the kind of guilt you're talking about to me is greed. It's this need for absolution. So it's a wanting, 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 wanting. I have a don't want, don't want, don't want, don't want, don't want. So the thing that you're trying to see is the nature of the speech itself. And all these things that we're talking about, you can hear the nature of the speech itself. That's what's painful. But what we're trying to see, you're almost like asking yourself, is this timely? Is it affectionate? Is it beneficial? Spoken with a mind with goodwill. Is it even truthful? Most of these stories we tell ourselves, the mind says, it's making it up. It's not, we don't even know. It's like my mind was taking my energy and coming up with some use of it. But it was robbing me of what I had really worked hard to obtain by sitting in all those sits and doing all that walking, and I would get to the stillness and then I would lose it in some 2 days of rage. So you want to see what this guilt is preventing you from seeing. And mostly guilt prevents us from just seeing the harmful nature of our conduct. And instead, we get caught in this greed of wanting it to be otherwise, or trying to, all the blaming and shaming we do on us keeps us from feeling how harmful our behavior is. Instead, we hate ourselves. So it seems like, oh, I'm really into how bad I am. But no, we flipped the switch from the harm we did to someone else, to look at how terrible I am. And in a way, it's kind of like a victimizing ourselves, you know, because we're so terrible. But you want, it's not the stopping or interrupting of the guilt. You want to see what you're doing to yourself. So even though you have these guilt thoughts, this is the way you look at it. You could just look at me, right? You're looking at Tuareg. You're looking at the computer. You're looking at something. Or you could soften your eyes and you could just let your eyes see. And then you see me, see the Buddha, see light. You see, it softens, it tempers, it loses its edges and it begins to get softer and you can see more. That's what you're trying to do. You're not trying to get rid of the guilt and you're not trying to wallow in the guilt. You're trying to understand that if this guilt keeps coming back, chances are there's energy in the body you have not actually let go of. And you've not actually come into the fullness of what happened. Instead, you'll jump in the guilt the way my mind would jump into anger. So this practice is really about finding a way to soften around that guilt. Soften, not in the story. You're not looking at the story. You're softening around the felt sense of this. What does this actually feel like? And begin to soften around it. It's very painful. But in that painfulness, you might begin to hear just how aggressive you actually are. And in that, you're going into the grounds where you can liberate your mind. Because part of the guilt is so you don't see how aggressive you are. And part of my rage is so I wouldn't see how mean I was. And so when you first start seeing that, it's very painful. We don't like it. We don't want to accept it. But it's not you. It really is just a mind's habit. And you got to kind of soften. And gradually that you'll keep doing the guilting. But gradually you begin to see the unnecessariness of that guilting rather than I could see the unnecessariness of my anger and how the mind was taking it from me, taking my practice from me. And then the ants made sense because it was a way to keep me from getting tumbling into the story. So once you soften around the guilt a little bit here, so you're not running from it and you're not wallowing in it, then you can find something that you could steady your attention on and stay with the sensation, let the body digest it. Because usually it's just undigested energy. If you keep reliving a story, that tells you the body has some energy around that story it has not digested. And so it's just roaming around in your body. And that energy, every time the mind feels it or every time you sense it, the mind hijacks it and relives the story again. And then goes back down in the body and roams around. You feel that? Oh, hijacks it again every time. So you want to put your attention on something so you can soften, put your attention on a focal point and let the body actually digest the energy of it. It is a art and a skill, but this is what we're learning how to do, is how to be with discomfort and not make it go away. Just be with it and let the body learn how to discharge it. You see?
Thank you.
Okay, well, we're just going to have to be quick. Okay, is it quick? I'm never quick, though. That's the problem. You can say it quick, but I'm never quick.
Let's try quick answers.
Okay.
So, Oh, okay. Thank you. So, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
All right. First question, I thought there was a part of the recipe that was missing when you were saying, you know, if you feel this anger while you're meditating, then, you know, you're letting your something part of you is using this energy that was coming from the meditation and something, you know, is happening. I thought part of the recipe is missing because at first it sounded like, you know, you're saying, well, watch out for that, look at it, you'll see it. And then the part that sounded like it was missing is what happens next. And I think you gave some examples in the questions about what to do with that, like think about where this anger is taking you, sit with it, think about where the guilt is coming from or taking you, or the frustration with yourself, all of these things. Can you maybe just say something like, is that what it is?
You're not thinking about it. What you want to do is feel it. That's what you want to do. But we can't feel the very things that we think are terrible about ourselves. So instead of feeling it and letting it move through us, just like all things do, we get caught in all these stories and reactivities. That's what all these different things are. So we start talking through all these different reactivities rather than letting ourselves feel through the discomfort of it.
Don't think about it. Feel through
it. That's right. Feel through it. And so the way that you feel through anything is you have to find something to put your attention on, and you put your attention on that. So for me, it was the ants. But the breath is very soft, and so many times people will try to put their focus on the breath, and it won't work because it's too soft. So you have to find something that you can put your attention on to hold your, this thinking mind, hold its attention on something, and let your body feel through the discomfort. And that, over time, you actually learn how to let that discomfort come up and not get lost in the story. Yeah. You're welcome. Good.